Hey there, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Over the past week or so, the international media has been quite focused on the COP26 conference currently being held in Glasgow, Scotland, a conference which you may have heard described by mainstream media outlets as the most important climate-focused conference in decades. However, if you've been following my recent work, you will know that this conference is a key part of the effort to transition from the COVID-19-inspired pandemic of fear to another pandemic of fear inspired by climate change. Such fear is necessary in order for the same forces present at COP26 to implement one of the conference's other main focuses, the infrastructure for a new economic system designed by central and Wall Street bankers that, if implemented, will be for their benefit, not for the benefit of people in the planet. COP26 is giving some of the biggest plutocrats in the world the opportunity to greenwash their plans for complete economic domination, which includes, among other things, the financialization of the entire natural world under the guise of protecting it. Though COP officially stands for Conference of the Parties, what it really should stand for is Conference of Propaganda, as the most vocal proponents of so-called drastic climate action at the conference have already, just in the conference's first few days, engaged in gross acts of hypocrisy that show that they want the public to be afraid of climate peril and to completely transform their lives to ostensibly combat it, while they themselves continue to live luxurious lives that are unimpeded by carbon rationing and other such measures they publicly promote. Joining me today to discuss these issues and more is Charlie Robinson. Charlie is the host of the Macro Aggressions podcast, which you can find on Rockfin and other podcasting platforms, and he is also now the author of several books, the most recent of which was published in September and is called Hypocrisy, spelled Hypocrazy, Surviving in a World of Cultural Double Standards. This is also his third appearance on the Unlimited Hangout podcast, having previously appeared in episodes 2 and 11. Great to have you back on the show, Charlie. How's it going?
It's going fine. How are you doing?
Oh, you know, as well as anyone can be in these crazy times.
Yeah.
Nuts. And I'm about to bring another little person into this crazy world, so...
That's okay. I feel like that might help to balance out some of the crazy being raised by you. Your kids are going to have a much different view of the world than most people out there that refuse to be aware of what is happening around them.
Well, thanks. I actually sort of expanded on my views on that. It was featured recently in a Corbett Report podcast about, you know, why having kids these days is really important for people that are aware of these issues and bigger things at stake. So, you know, even though things seem dire, it's still important to remember that we're ultimately fighting against what more often than not looks like a death cult. And what better way to do that than by, you know, prioritizing life, however one does that in their life.
Absolutely. I think that's probably the best strategy towards dealing with this evil that's in the world.
Right on. So you have a new book out called Hypocrisy, Hypocrazy.
Yes.
which examines 8 major areas of hypocrisy that are staring us in the face every day. So with climate change now being the topic of the hour in the mainstream media, most recently because of COP26, right? What have your favorite moments of hypocrisy at the conference been so far?
Well, where do I even begin? There's so many to choose from. I mean, we could start with the 400 private jets that are flying in for this climate conference. That would be a little too obvious, though. Or maybe the motorcades, maybe how many people Biden brought with him and all of the change, you know, the cars and the beast and all of that stuff that goes. But how about we just settle on the fact that the largest contributor of pollution in the world, China, isn't at the conference and has no interest of being at the conference and has told those people at the conference, you know, if you'd like for us to join, maybe we'll do it via Skype or something. But, you know, we're not coming to meet with you guys. So it's really hard to, I mean, it is a conference of hypocrisy because this Green New Deal, this greenwashing, this carbon zero desire that these people have is, first of all, it's unattainable and shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't even be trying to get to carbon zero. But beyond that, if you made a list of the least likely people to actually hold up their end of the bargain, it would be the people that are running these conferences right now. They're the ones that need to be held accountable, and yet they're throwing the conferences, trying to tell us, you know, of course, flipping the blame onto the common people. It's always our fault that things are going so wrong. If only we would do what they said, this world would be a much better place. But I get the feeling that they have big plans for us on how they want to transform humanity, and it's probably not going to be in our best interest.
Yeah, well, I think that is pretty clear, to say the least, given some of the big names attending this conference, people who aren't exactly known for putting the interests of the public or the planet first. You know, some of the big headlines that have come out of COP26 so far involve deals made or pledges made by, I don't know, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Larry Fink, Mike Bloomberg. You know, some of these people that normally, I guess, people on the left or the progressive left normally hate on quite considerably. And but apparently when they say they're going to donate X amount of money to the planet, you know, it's fine without even really looking so much into what groups are they're actually giving money to. They have nice sounding names, maybe NGO names that imply that they're going to be involved in some sort of sustainable venture. But really, you end up looking at their funding, I don't know, and you have like Syngenta GMO seed companies there. I mean, it's pretty insane. And I just, I don't know. I just can't believe that a lot of people are falling for this, given the parties involved, you know, that these, you know, COP26, they've made it pretty clear, you know, the first couple days that have already happened were speeches by world leaders where they pontificate and say blah, 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 and do like their PR spiel, essentially. But after that, it's really like closed door backroom deals between, you know, these clown politicians. You know, Joe Biden, who falls asleep at the conference, brings 85 cars and a motorcade, and his speech is basically just like shitting on China and Russia for not coming. But you know, I don't know. That's really, and then falling asleep.
But isn't that kind of perfect, though? Isn't that a perfect encapsulation of America? We just overdo it. We bring the whole motorcade. We spend the entire conference blaming everybody else, and then when it's our turn, we're asleep at the wheel. I mean, that pretty much just sums it all up. He went on to say this is not just a moral imperative, but an economic imperative as well. Well, listen, I'm not interested in taking economic advice from Joe Biden.
Yeah,
he is the wrong person to be in charge of the, you know, talking about. You know, he's trying to pitch a $1.75 trillion spending package with all these climate initiatives in it. And he can't even stay awake during the conference. Now, to be fair, I would probably be falling asleep during these conferences as well. Actually, I'd probably be so enraged that I would have to escort myself out. But it says so much about America in general, but the fact that we come into these conferences and start trying to boss everybody around and act like, you know, act like we always do, and then, you know, leave the conference and go home. And of course, expect all these other countries to pick up, you know, take over for where we left off. I'm not a huge fan of these summits. You and I were talking about parallel summits or additional summits happening. The Bloomberg New Economy Forum, we'll probably get into that. But yeah. I don't know if you noticed, there is another forum that's called Forum for a New Economy, not to be confused with the Bloomberg New Economy Forum.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah.
And this one is, you will appreciate.
Is this also this month in November?
No, this happened in Berlin, but it's academic partners. They invited Harvard and Princeton, Columbia and Berkeley and London School of Economics, and they had the same sort of thing. They talked about a concept called narrative economics and having climate change discussions with the interest of reducing inequality and the three R's: recovery, resilience, and renewal. So it's not limited to these COP26 meetings where they get together and throw around all these buzzwords and then do nothing except enslave humanity. It's a cottage industry.
Okay, that's really funny. that it's another new economy forum. It has how many R's? What, the three R's, the four R's?
It's got the three R's. It's recovery, resilience, and renewal.
I'm pretty sure the Bloomberg one has like the three P's or something like that. The Bloomberg New Economy Forum with the three P's and the Forum for a New Economy with four R's. I mean, these guys, man, they need to like diversify their PR teams. Maybe just
they're
a little
bit. They're going to the same... The same think tanks are telling them, you know what Americans really need? You know, listen, in America, I put this in the new book. We've got the three R's: reading, writing, and arithmetic. And if you go by that, that's actually quite fitting too, because you would have to misspell two of the three R's in order to be grammatically correct. So that, of course, is yet another encapsulation of where America has gone these days, but I digress.
All right. So, any other acts of hypocrisy, really quick? You wanna touch on? There was another one that I did see more recently that was, I think, 60% of the meals being served at COP26 have dairy and meat in them, and these are the people saying no meat for you, bug time.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know. I think it's just another encapsulation of the same attitude that was seen with COVID. You know, masks for thee, but not for me.
Yes.
And quarantine for thee and not for me. And the same sort of attitude when it comes to the measures that we're hearing more and more about all the time. They want regular people to implement in terms of a diet or travel, things like that.
Well, I did see Boris Johnson try to relate to the commoners by saying that the planet was down 5-1, like it was a football game. But after 2 days at this COP26 summit, he said that his guys have scored two goals and it's now 5-3. So in case you didn't already hate Boris Johnson enough, if you're a football fan or in the United States, a soccer fan, just know that he is now totally bastardizing your favorite sport by dragging this into the climate change. And in his mind, he just scored two goals in the last 2 days. So if you see Boris Johnson out and about, make sure to congratulate him any way you see fit.
Oh, my gosh. What a clown. He and Joe Biden. What a pair. Anyway, speaking of other UK figureheads, there was a bit of hubbub, I guess you could say, about a speech that Prince Charles of the UK made, I believe it was opening day of COP26, in that speech. It actually was interesting that the excerpts of that speech that different mainstream media outlets chose to lead with, a lot of them avoided what I would argue was the most important part of that speech, where he says, quote, a vast military style campaign, end quote, is needed to marshal the strength of the global private sector to push for a fundamental economic transition. That's quite telling, because this is supposed to be, you know, about environmentalism, saving the planet, blah, blah, blah. But here we have talks about fundamental economic transition, global private sector, vast military style campaign. Those aren't usually the words used by environmentalists, at least not typically. I don't know. It definitely seems a little alarming, but it of course makes sense when, you know, and start looking into a lot of the talk going on at COP26, which is really about creating a new economic system, as I sort of mentioned in the intro to this podcast. Do you have any thoughts on that particular speech?
So the biggest trust fund kid in the world, who is also Jimmy Savile's best friend, wants us to remake the economics of society, and we're just supposed to snap to it and get on it. I mean, it's so preposterous and insane that these people have the audacity to stand up there like we care what they have to say. And well, I guess we sort of have to care in a sense, because they're so dangerous. We have to keep an eye on them. But to have the audacity to think that we're just going to listen to what Prince Charles, like, in all, with all due respect, what has Prince Charles ever done that's worthy of him leading us into anything. This is like an economic remaking of society. And this guy's going to be in charge of it. The guy that hasn't figured out a way to kill his mother and become king. So he's clearly not cut out for this job. He's best friends with some of the worst people on the planet. His entire family is. They were Nazis back in World War II. We're not allowed to talk about that. And these guys are in charge of the transformation. I mean, I feel like part of this is going to be on us to stand up and say, we refuse this. We are not participating in this. These are not we don't grant these so-called leaders the authority to change society. And we need to kind of take some responsibility in this, because they're going to do whatever they want to us until we stand up. We've watched this over the last 18 months with COVID. It's quite clear. You can't reason with these people. You can't sit them down and explain, well, you know, I think this is a bad idea. They've got a much bigger plan. This is coming from people above them. This is coming for, this is the Build Back Better directive and all that stuff. It's very, very important to their agenda that this all happen according to the way in which they need it to happen. But that is going to require us, our compliance. And that is something that we can and should withhold from this whole equation, because if we just allow them to push these agendas unfettered, we're going to wind up enslaved. And it's not even so much a matter of debate. It's just an understanding of history and how things have gone for people in the past when they've granted the people in positions of power undue influence over their lives. It just never ends well. So we need to kind of take advantage of this wealth of information we have at our fingertips called the internet, where, yes, there's a lot of fake stuff out there, but there's a lot of really good information out there too. Read about history and understand what happens when authoritarian regimes like this, and this is, let's be clear, this is an authoritarian regime disguised as a climate savior coming to save the world from yet another invisible killer. First it was terrorism. Then it was COVID. It's just around the corner, Whitney. It's going to get you if we don't throw more money at the military. That COVID is going to get you. And now it's carbon, which, by the way, we need to live. And you know, in this planet, this beautiful planet that we're on has been functioning just fine for billions of years. But now Prince Charles needs to come and fix it. I don't know. Color me a little bit skeptical.
What this speech to me is saying, or particularly that part, is he's talking about the global private sector, right? And so if you look at who's really driving a lot of this, it really does seem to come from the bankers, the private sector, basically doing a coup, essentially, you could argue, to impose a new economic system on the world. And the discussion of this military-style campaign, that phrasing I find really vast military-style campaign, nonetheless, to me really suggests some sort of authoritarian, he's calling for an authoritarian onslaught, really. That's sort of, you know, this is a crisis on par with COVID or worse or something like that. So all the authoritarian abuses we saw during the COVID crisis, things like that and beyond, will be justified in the name of saving the planet. And we're doing this, to essentially force all private financial flows, I guess you could say, into the creation of this new economic system. I don't know if you agree with my interpretation there, but it definitely seems pointing towards that. And if you look at, you know, some of the people we can talk about later that are really involved in a lot of stuff going on here, like Mark Carney, Larry Fink, some of these guys, it definitely seems like that is sort of where this is going.
Yeah. And it's disgusting, of course, but not surprising that we're starting to see this is, you know, people are always throwing around that term fascism and everybody's a fascist. But in actuality, when you look at sort of the definition of fascism, the blending of the state and big business, that's really where we are here. That's probably an accurate term for maybe corporatism. I don't know. However you want. Benefit of the corporations. Well, I mean, they're both kind of benefiting here, but they're going to find a way to to run this through the banks. We've already seen that with this sort of, I don't know, quasi merger of the Fed and BlackRock and what they're
So
doing there.
insane, yeah.
It's totally insane. We're already seeing, to allow that company to be in charge of money, and that it's we're getting into some very dangerous territory where the lines between corporate boardrooms and Washington think tanks are increasingly blurred. It's hard to tell where the authority is coming from. Is it coming from Larry Fink? I mean, obviously he has a financial interest in this, or is he being instructed by people above him, by the Atlantic Council or the Club of Rome or World Economic Forum or all three of them? Or, who's really involved in this? And when you add that layer of big business to it, though you might initially think, oh, well, this will add a layer of transparency, I would suggest that it makes it even more murky to figure out who's really in charge there. You add another board of directors with their sorts of interests and things like that, and we're going to get ourselves into a very dangerous world where what we saw during COVID, the activation, the deputization of the Karens of the world with the task of saving us from this virus. Just think, and the insanity that ensued with that, calling the police if there are too many cars in your neighbor's driveway on Thanksgiving and that sort of madness. Just think what would happen when these people are tasked with their new responsibility of saving the world. Oh my God. I mean, it is going to be not it's not just the surveillance state component of this that freaks me out. It's now my neighbors that are going to, because everywhere you go when you talk about the coming social credit system, rewarding people that are ratting out their neighbors by increasing their social credit score is something that I think we could probably see. And you might not even need to incentivize them with that, as long as they think that they're out there preventing you from, putting the last plastic bottle in the landfill that's going to ultimately send this earth, I don't know, exploding or whatever they think is going to happen when we cross this imaginary threshold of destroying the world. It's going to get us into a situation where the people that are hysterical about this are the most dangerous part of your day that you're going to have to sort of interact with them, navigate them at work. They're seeking to transform society, but they need our help in doing that. And if anything is clear, it's that the way they did that with COVID, the mistakes that were made, I get the feeling they're going to try and learn from those with regard to this climate emergency that's coming in the heels of COVID, and they might not make those same mistakes twice.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say too. And I think a lot of the way they're going to end up selling what they're setting up the infrastructure and planning for now at things like COP26, which, by the way, the sort of power structure you were talking about. My last guest has a really good sort of hierarchy view of what that system looks like in practice. He calls it the global public-private partnership, and really, what we see at COP26 is that essentially taking place. But you are totally right; they do really need regular people to enforce this to some degree, and I think that's why it's so important to point out to those people in advance that basically the people that created the environmental crisis they're so freaked out about are the ones allegedly planning how to save it, pointing out their plans, the financialized nature, and all of this stuff. But there is a hidden issue here that you sort of touched on. That's starting to come to the forefront a little more, that there's these new products. I guess they're rolling out some in the form of credit cards, some in, I think there's one in Mexico that's like an app that gives you points for engaging in appropriate behaviors. Whoever, decides what that appropriate behavior is another issue entirely. But you get points or you get money for engaging in, they're essentially gamifying the behavior they want people to engage in, and sort of what you laid out is how that could develop into the future. But I think a lot of people are unfortunately pretty susceptible to that. But I think the main selling point that they're going to be using here, we've already sort of seen the crisis they plan to capitalize off of form itself, the supply chain crisis, an energy crisis, at least in Europe for now, I think also in China, potentially spreading beyond that, which of course, you know, the energy crisis will likely lead to some sort of restriction of food supply globally. All of that, I think they'll blame on climate change. And when you have people in a situation of food insecurity and having to choose between feeding themselves and heating their homes, it's going to be a lot of that hysteria you mentioned is going to be much worse than it was during COVID-19.
Yeah, and they're going to use, so there's also that science component to COVID that there will be with this new environmental push as well, which is, hey, the science says that this virus is going to kill everyone. And then, of course, the science changes. But and we're not allowed to understand the science. We're just dummies, right? We have to have the priest class interpret the data,
yeah,
like the Faucis of the world. And then he goes on, you know, on high and receives the data, and then he disseminates it to us, and because we're too stupid to understand it. So the same tactics that they used with the COVID scientific information, which trust the science, there's no such thing as bot science, you know, the only source of authoritative news is coming from us, Jacinda Ardern, you know, stuff like that. Expect that for the climate situation as well, where they roll out the numbers, you know, 0.5 degrees centigrade of, rise already this year. And then they're going to say, you're anti-science if you don't believe all of this science. And you'll, of course, then you'll have articles out and Whitney will have written, yeah, well, if you check this company and who financed that company, you'll see that it leads back to this person. And everyone will go, see, the science is garbage, you know, but they'll do it and they'll get enough people that don't dig in. And they'll say, hey, listen, I saw it on MSNBC or CNN that ocean temperatures are rising already, and that you know, we're all going to die in 12 years and all this stuff. And it's like, this is so the same propaganda narrative of trust the science and all of that. We should expect even the very weird religious nature of COVID, the way people have embraced it. I watched this interview, a video interview with somebody, she was a health minister, I want to say in Alberta, someplace. And she walked up to the podium, and at the podium, there was like a Purell pump, hand sanitizer thing in a pump. She walked up to the podium, didn't say anything, two pumps, wiped it in her hands, took her mask off on her right ear, took her mask off on her left ear, folded the flaps, put it carefully down on the podium in front of her, did two more pumps, wiped it around in her hands, and then took a breath and then went into her speech. And I was like, this is like a ritual. This is performance art, or it had a religious feel to it. I was like, okay, they've got their little, they've got their talismans or something. They've got their, you know, it just occurred to me while watching that we had kind of joked about, you know, they're sort of the deification of Fauci and all this stuff. But really, they took the idea of the COVID and turned it into, you know, kind of cult-like thinking. And I would expect that the same thing will happen with the climate. Well, I mean, I know it'll happen because we already have. We've had a lot of that for a while. We've had Greenpeace, we've had the Extinction Rebellion people and all that stuff. So we know there's going to be that. But the idea that that they're saving the planet and we're destroying the planet, and that humanity has to choose which side you're going to be on. Well, of course, you're going to be on the side that's saving the planet, right? But the problem is that will be a lie created by people that have a very easy time lying. And it takes me back to these two paragraphs that they wrote in this book. The Club of Rome put out this book, The Limits to Growth. And in that, they kind of gave up the plan. Now, the Club of Rome was started by David Rockefeller and Dr. Alexander King, two of the worst people in the world. Dr. Alexander King started Tavistock, or he was involved in Tavistock. He was co-founded NATO, the Committee of 300, like a dangerous individual. And when they put the Club of Rome together, part of this was for the environmental side of it. Now, if you can imagine David Rockefeller caring about the planet, well, then you've got
the oil family. How does everyone forget about this?
Yeah. He's coming to save the world. But here's a little clip from their book, and it sort of gives up what their plan is. And this is what they say: the common enemy of humanity is man. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. We believe humanity requires a common motivation, namely a common adversary, in order to realize world government. It does not matter if this common enemy is a real one or one invented for the purpose. So they are explaining that they are going to use the idea of global warming. This was written in 1971 when they put this out, as the new enemy to unite us, to create a one world government. And they don't care if they need to fake this enemy or not. I mean, it's really hard after reading that. It's really hard to take anything they say seriously.
Oh, well, I'm really glad you brought up Limits to Growth in the Club of Rome, where people need to be looking at that, because a lot of people are looking at the World Economic Forum, right, because they're more visible. But the World Economic Forum and their origins intimately tied to the Club of Rome and Limits of Growth. If you read the article on Unlimited Hangout, Schwab Family Values by Johnny Bedmore, it goes into detail on that on the in the end about how the creation of the World Economic Forum, their first annual meeting highlighted and was basically all about limits to growth and how Club of Rome was involved and sort of getting the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab on his feet, very intimately connected organizations.
One of the things that they say, a term that the Club of Rome uses, which I found to be remarkable, is something called disease surveillance. And that is, and so, like, the idea that they're going to use diseases as the pretext to surveil people is interesting. They also say, we are living beyond the carrying capacity of this planet. The pandemic is a manifestation of this fact. So they're fully in this camp of, humanity is the problem. This whole world would work a lot better if it wasn't for all these stupid people. Maybe we can figure out a way to save humanity by, fighting this climate change, wink, wink, which is getting rid of a bunch of these people. So and of course the Club of Rome is also based in Switzerland too. So there's a lot of overlap between these organizations. I think that if people were to think of something like the United Nations, the Club of Rome, the World Economic Forum, all of these, it's like a Venn diagram where there's intersections. You can be a member of all of them. You don't have to pick one team to play on. You can play on multiple teams, and their agendas overlap sort of nicely. So anything that the World Economic Forum doesn't cover, the Club of Rome will probably take care of it on the back end.
Right. So what you talked about, disease surveillance, is really important too, because in the context of, these guys saying they're saving the planet, there's actually a huge increase in funding of R&D by these types of actors into disease and pandemic surveillance post-COVID. But a lot of it has to do with monitoring the natural world. A lot of that is going to be or rural areas. Some of them talk about, sensors, unique identifiers, for forests and different natural assets, right? This is back in, for example, a 2018 white paper from the World Economic Forum talking about the revolution, on being on the threshold of the revolution and digital identity, talks expressly about things like forests having their own, their own digital, identifiers. This sort of goes along with the context of what I wrote about recently, natural asset corporations, which is essentially something between a group that's basically a front from the Rockefeller Foundation called the Intrinsic Exchange Group and the New York Stock Exchange, about creating, basically financializing natural assets, forests, ecological processes, things that have never been part of markets before, creating a whole new asset class that they can essentially charge people for, you know, charge people for things that previously they couldn't, you know, like the air you breathe, or being charged a tax on food for the ecological process that made growing food in the soil in this area possible, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. It's insane. The Club of Rome has a term for this. They call it account for natural capital and value nature on their balance sheets. I mean, is there anything that just screams? I mean, that to me just screams transhumanism, where you take something as beautiful as nature and you try and stuff it into an Excel spreadsheet as best you can and put some sort of and quantify that somehow. It's really disgusting, but I don't think that we should be too surprised, because this is coming to us from the same group that wants genetically modified food, which they couldn't patent in the natural form, so they make it just one deviation away from being natural, and so now it's technically unnatural, and they can patent that. I mean, look, I think a fair but insane topic of conversation to have would be that, you know, is that mentality of tweaking something natural and making it just a little bit unnatural in order to own the rights, in order to own the patents on it, can we not have that discussion about what's happening with people when they're injecting these mRNA vaccines into their body? Are they not becoming just one notch less human? Maybe over time, this incrementally builds up to the fact that you now classify these people as technically not human. And if they're not human anymore, well, then maybe what are they? And how do we classify them? And if we can classify them in something other than human, can they be owned? And so now we get into this weird crisis where you start thinking about that if they can change people just enough, they can then technically own them in some way, shape, or form, maybe even trade them on stock markets. And listen, of course, that sounds insane, but it's no more insane if you understand that they're trying to do that with nature already. So it seems like a reasonable leap.
Well, the Natural Asset Corporation is about them taking ownership of nature, essentially, and applying the you'll own nothing and be happy thing to that. And what you also touched on with the patents, that is happening, though, with the human genome and the Human Genome Project. And every time there's a particular gene discovered by any one of these companies in this burgeoning field of biotech and gene editing medicine and all that stuff, they patent it. So, you know, there's a patent, an effort to patent pretty much every gene and every life form. It's not just humans either. It's also going on for animals. And I think ultimately what you're going to have if this continues unimpeded, and of course the normalization of mRNA vaccines is ushering this in, but what you're eventually going to have is a situation where they can claim ownership over any life form, essentially. And if that involves introducing things into the human body that implants a patented gene in a particular person, and they can claim ownership over that person's genetic material. What implications does that have? I mean, you know, some people may say that sounds really crazy, but that is. I mean, there have been people that have been warning about this patent issue since the Human Genome Project came to its conclusion. If you look at the people that were behind that project, people like Craig Venter or Epstein-funded Eric Lander, who's now Biden's top science advisor, and you look at what they've been doing since the Human Genome Project and what it has to do with patenting life and patenting specific genes that are present in millions and millions and millions, potentially all people, things like that. It's just insanely alarming. And I think, you know, part of what's gone on in the past year and a half with COVID, the effort to normalize mRNA vaccines and therapies and products is really to open the door on this whole era of gene editing people, sort of like there was that time when the floodgates opened on, oh, now we can genetically modify crops and plants and all of this stuff. There's going to be an effort not too far in the future to sort of normalize that with people, because we have all of these health startups that have been waiting in the wings for several years that use things like CRISPR, for example, to edit the human genome, even though more and more studies come out every year showing that CRISPR actually causes a lot of gene damage or genotoxic, right? But they're being still very heavily promoted by the same, I guess you could say, network of individuals. And, you know, I think the mRNA vaccines, normalizing that in the public consciousness is a major step towards that, because before COVID, they kept saying that public distrust of these technologies was like one of their main barriers to getting these products to market and getting them widely used by people. And I think sort of the Trojan horse inherent in that is sort of what you touched on, the patenting of genes and of life itself. And it's all very much related to this effort to financialize human nature. There's also, you know, talking about financializing natural capital, there's also major efforts to do that for human capital or social capital. And some of these organizations that have popped up to sort of offer the protocols for how to quantify all of these things, like the Capitals Coalition, you know, they have a human capital protocol, a social capital protocol, and a natural capital protocol. And they're intimately connected to these, you know, the World Economic Forum, the efforts to produce natural asset corporations and all of this stuff. And a lot of the same players are also involved at COP26. What do you know?
Yeah. And they're also involved in this Bloomberg New Economy Forum that's happening in Singapore. You need to get yourself to Singapore if you can between the 16th and 19th of November, because I can't imagine you missing the presentation on pandemic preparedness that will be given by Bill Gates. And after that one, I think you should probably see if you can sneak over to the topic, the presentation, The Emerging World Order. That'll be presented by Tony Blair. I'm sure that's going to be fascinating. We're going to figure out exactly how to restore trust. Oh, that's a different one. Combating truth decay, restoring trust. They're going to have
tooth decay. I can't believe these people.
Combating truth decay. Better floss. Oh my goodness. But the advisory board, don't worry. The advisory board is filled with some of the best people in the world. They're going to get to the bottom of this. Bill Gates, Condoleezza Rice, Lawrence Summers, Margaret Chan, who is the former director general of the World Health Organization, and Neil Shen, who's at Sequoia Capital. He's one of the guys that makes sure that the money finds all of these new corporations that are out there taking on, you know, taking on this challenge of trying to identify and account for every living thing on this planet. I mean, the mentality that it requires to even ponder this concept of trying to, we've joked about these people are trying to run the world and everything like this. They are trying to classify and categorize everything in the world, that's for sure. Not like they're the Audubon Society, you know, like they're trying to, like, hey, let's figure out if there's a new type of bird out there. No, they're looking to do that so that they can own that bird and then lease that bird out to you, because you'll own nothing and be happy because this is part of their plan for society. So it's, you know, part of me feels like these people are just having fantasies about what they want to do, that this all sounds too scientific and too you know, unbelievable. But then I pull back from that rather quickly, because I have come to understand just exactly how dangerous these people are, and that if it was, you know, you and your stoner friends talking about taking over the world, that's one thing. But when these people get together, they actually have the ability to do it. And when they talk about this transhumanist agenda and the blending of man with machine, the man that they're talking about blending is you. And this should be alarming to everyone. And I think that if people have been slow to figure out COVID. Not your audience, not my audience. We understand where this is going, but there's a lot of people out there that have been kind of slow to pick up COVID. I don't know that I can expect them to be any quicker about picking up this new agenda that's using the environment as cover, as a shield to deflect criticism from what they're really doing, which is trying to own the world under the guise of saving the world. It's an ambitious project, but they've got the right psychopaths in place to try and make a run at this. But I'll tell you, this is going to be one of there's a lot of topics out there. There's a lot of things that we could get it, into and talk about, but this is going to be one of those sneaky ones that comes out of nowhere and is all of a sudden one of the most important things that we face. If we allow them, or we are asleep at the wheel and these people are able to remake society, they will take it back to the kings and serfs. They think of themselves as the kings anyway. They act as if, so we shouldn't be surprised if their policies reflect that as well. So this is a dangerous time for us. And I don't want to be like hyperbolic about this. And I don't want to be like, trying to scare people. I think that there's a certain amount of fear that people need to have, like a healthy amount of fear that people need to have, to realize that these people are very dangerous, and that the plans that they're coming up with are going to impact us. They're going to impact our kids' kids. And if they do it the right way, meaning, the way that works best for them, we're going to be locked out of society, and it's going to be Elysium. It's going to be two tiers of society where we're eating the crickets and they're eating the real food. And we simply cannot allow that to happen, because where we are standing right now, we still have the ability to prevent that. But we're going to get to a point in the not too distant future where our time is coming gone to make these changes. So we need to really be paying attention right now.
Right. So you brought up transhumanism. Let's keep in mind the same people talking about climate change, we're going to save the planet with green finance and all of this stuff, are the same people also pushing for the fourth industrial revolution and the metaverse, and having AI take all the jobs and putting robots and sensors everywhere, making smart cities and making all of this technology that depends on super exploitative mining practices. They've already said there's this mining conglomerate that's backed by people like Bloomberg and Jeff Bezos and a bunch of other, I think even Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook is on there. I'm going to be talking with Corey Morningstar about this next week. They have essentially announced all of the world's lithium, nickel, and like a other long list of nickels is required for this transition. So basically, they're going to lock down all those resources. I think that's one of the other major reasons I wrote about this earlier in the year, why Magufuli in Tanzania was axed. Wasn't just because of his COVID stance. It's because he was nationalizing the mines, which includes the largest nickel deposit.
He's got to go.
yeah. And he was not, in line with these people. So, no. Definitely had to go. He also took it away from Glencore, which you don't do. That's the mining, company that was created by Mark Rich, the Mossad asset, and is now, I think he's still in charge, Nat Rothschild. That's not a company you fuck with like that. This is something that's going to be hugely exploitative, we're seeing, at the same time they're pushing for these changes to society for climate change and all of the stuff we have to save the planet, blah blah blah, we're having the launch of the metaverse take place at the same time from big tech, right, with Facebook. Now we have Microsoft making their big announced pivot into the metaverse space. The metaverse will be for you. The metaverse is how they're going to do neo-feudalism, I think, now. That the little people are going to be stuck in the metaverse, and that's how you're going to not use carbon, right? Because you won't be moving. You'll be living your life in a virtual reality, essentially. But these people will have the freedom to romp and roam wherever they choose and enjoy nature. They don't have to be in the metaverse, because we're also, all of this is going on, like ID 2020. promoting the idea now of the core of their digital ID system that they're promoting, freedom as a service. Freedom isn't a right anymore. They call it FaaS. They literally abbreviate it. Freedom as a service is at the core of the system. You can have the freedom if you can afford it, right? So who are the people in this system of financializing nature, natural capital, human capital, social capital that are going to have the freedom in the money, the points, whatever, however this new system works, right? To enjoy those types of freedoms, to not have to be strapped down and stuck in the metaverse all day. The people that own that stuff, right? The people that own the natural asset corporations and the natural assets and the human assets and the social assets and all of this stuff that they're moving with. So we have to keep in mind too, you know, this own nothing and be happy thing. A lot of that's gotten around. It's not just about them owning what they can own today. It's about them monetizing and then taking ownership of literally everything, most of which is not currently monetized today. And if you go to the intrinsic exchange group behind natural asset corporations, this Rockefeller Foundation thing, I mean, the opportunity per them is just the huge expansion of things they can buy and take ownership of by opening up this new asset class for them. It's totally insane. And it's obviously predatory. And going back to COP26, because I do want to keep some of the focus of what we're talking about today on that to an extent, because I think it's being really overlooked. The important parts of it anyway are being overlooked in general. One thing that has come out of this, or really it started a little bit before, but this is its big PR moment, I guess you could say, at COP26, is something called the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, which is being led by Mark Carney, former head of the Bank of England, former head of the Bank of Canada. Of course, he's also the UN envoy for green finance. What a convenient transition for him. And they, you know, got some positive press the other day because at COP26, they announced over $130 trillion of private capital is now committed to transforming the economy for net zero, right? But if you look at who's behind this financial alliance, it's Mark Carney and it's Mike Bloomberg. There's four people on the leadership board. The co-chair is Mark Carney. The other co-chair is Mike Bloomberg. The vice chair is one of Bloomberg's longtime underlings. And the other one is the UK government selected climate action champion is his official title, which just sounds...
With Satan unavailable? I mean, my God, what a lineup there. Kissinger wasn't on that panel. This is...
No, well, he's on what you mentioned earlier, the Bloomberg. Bloomberg is all over this stuff, right? So he's on this. Bloomberg is the co-chair for this Financial Alliance for Net Zero, but at his new economy forum, that's Mike Bloomberg, that's Henry Kissinger, and that's Hank Paulson, Goldman Sachs, former head of the Nature Conservancy, because he's very much like to rebrand as a conservationist after threatening Congress with martial law if they didn't bail out the Wall Street banks in 2008 when he was Secretary of the Treasury under Bush. You guys remember that? These are the people creating the new economy. They're going to do it for your benefit and for the planet's benefit, guys. I mean, if you really believe that these people are doing that, you might as well just give them your brain in a bag at this point. Like, I just, it's exhausting. Well,
it is exhausting. At this COP26 summit, they talked about the EU unveils basically cap and trade. They said that it must obtain a permit to emit carbon. It's 60 euros or $68 per metric ton of emission. They want to roll this out everywhere by 2025. And they are trying to cut emissions. They say that this will help to cut emissions by 55% by 2030. Of course, I'm sure they're just making those numbers up. They plan on doing they want to put tariffs on steel and chemicals and cement from companies or countries where emissions are higher. So they want to punish those countries. Of course, you know, like I said, China didn't show up to this. Russia says we're not interested in participating. They know what's going on. They're not interested in playing this game. But this is a really bad time to add tariffs because ultimately they'll get passed down to the consumers. And, you know, maybe don't do that when you're in the middle of hyperinflating the world's reserve currency and you've got massive supply chain issues. But you know, I would suggest that they are doing all of this, that these supply chain issues, the things that are falling apart, is all part of this strategy of tension, you know, to just keep everybody, use that old school Operation Gladio concept of just keeping everybody a bit destabilized and unable to really get their feet underneath them. Where they're trying to take this with cap and trade, it really shouldn't surprise anybody when they realize that, like, what was going on with Enron back in the
I
day? Well,
was just about to bring up Enron. Good for
they
you.
were doing this cap and trade, carbon trading sort of thing. Okay, and who went to prison on that? Well, who was supposed to go to prison but allegedly died? Ken Lay, right? And who was Ken Lay's best friend in the world who taught him this carbon tax hustle, or who he taught the carbon tax hustle to? Al Gore. Al Gore and Ken Lay are buddies, right? So that this whole concept of quantifying, of saying, all right, we're going to set this allowable limit of carbon output, and then we're going to tax anything above that. And then we're going to take that money and we're going to use it to, I don't know, well, we'll just pretend like we're going to fix things with it, but we're really not going to fix it. This takes you into what the Club of Rome was talking about when they're talking about the common enemy of humanity is man, and that this is how they want to use this the common adversary to realize the one world government. So they're moving this down the line, these cap and trade deals, this carbon taxes. They're gonna set this. What if you think about it? It's a genius scam. It's like every other scam that the government's come up with. They take away something from you just because they decide they're gonna take. They say it's dangerous and they're gonna have to take it away from you, and then they license it back to you for money, whether that's like a hunting license or a marriage license or a fishing license or some freedom that you had. The state takes it and they say, well, you can have it, but you have to pay us and a licensing fee for it every time. So this cap and trade is just, think of that as like a carbon scam, creating a brand new marketplace, which they love rigging marketplaces. And when you've got Hank Paulson involved in it, you know that that marketplace will be rigged as the best way that you can possibly rig a marketplace, right? Because those guys know how to do it. So you've got this imaginary, you've got this new asset class, this carbon offsets that you can give waivers to companies or countries that you need to kind of continue doing their thing. Hey, Walmart, you off, you know, you create a lot of excess carbon, but you know what? Since you've got one of your people on this council, we'll give you an exemption. ExxonMobil gets an exemption. You know, all the real people that are contributing to this pollution, they're going to get waivers. But the rest of us will be, it'll start with c countries, and then it'll move to corporations, and then eventually it'll move to people. And you have exceeded your carbon output for this month, and you just can't do anymore. And that's not an insane pipe dream. We've started to see that, and I think you even mentioned it with some of these new what's it's a financial instrument. I think it's a credit card that is monitoring the things that you buy based on their ESG score, or the companies that are selling the things that you buy, and assigning a value, a carbon value, to the widgets that you buy using your credit card. And if you, I think initially what their plan is that if you buy the right things, you get more reward points. But eventually it'll get to the point where if you try to buy the wrong things, you just won't even be allowed to buy them. So we're starting to see everything get a carbon sort of, everything's going to start to have this carbon score slant to it, where they can then quantify your purchases and then make a determination whether you, as a consumer, are being a, I mean, we need you to be a consumer, that's essential, but we need you to buy the right things. And by the right things, I mean they've got to come from the companies that will give you the prop, you know, the right score for it. So it'll be the Amazons, it'll be the company store, right? Amazons, Walmart, whoever has decided that as part of this agenda, you can only shop at their, maybe even have a Maybe even the central bank digital currency will be pre-programmed so that you can only use it on goods and services that fit this carbon score that are below the threshold. So there's going to be ways that they're going to manipulate us into accepting this. But the first part and the most important part is that they have got to get everybody terrified of the fact that we are producing too much carbon dioxide. And if they can get people accepting that that is going to kill the planet and we're all going to die in 12 years, then they can modify your behavior in a way that will make you do the things that they want you to do. So the carbon component of this is going to wind up playing a much bigger role in our lives moving forward, unfortunately.
Well, some of what you laid out is already happening. I forget the name of the company, but the World Economic Forum was recently promoting a credit card company that calculates, you know, basically how much carbon you're spending based on your purchases made with that card. And I mean, how long until that's integrated into this infrastructure they're currently setting up at places like COP26? And obviously, you know, these people like Mark Carney, these central banker guys are also involved in the CBDC, central bank digital currency effort, like you say, is programmable, for all of that stuff. It has all of that capability. And it looks like several of those are going to start launching in countries around the world starting, around next year. Very alarming stuff. Really quick though, I do want to go back to this, Carney Bloomberg chaired Financial Alliance for Net Zero, because I do sort of want to dispel this notion, that's being, sort of circulated by the press that COP26, is useless and doesn't matter because China and Russia aren't there. Okay, but these guys are actually setting up some ways to do major damage right now. And I don't think it's gotten enough coverage, some of the stuff that they've said that really got my attention. And it's coming directly from this Financial Alliance for Net Zero group. So basically, for COP26, Mark Carney, as part of this alliance, is publishing this new plan. He says it's a plan on how to scale private capital flows to emerging and developing economies. One of the main tenets of that is developing country platforms to connect private capital committed to net zero, now at $130 trillion, right, with country projects, and scaling this with blended finance through MDBs, MDBs being multilateral development banks, like the World Bank, these like debt slavery banks. And the third point is developing high integrity, credible global carbon markets. So basically, this is using groups like the World Bank and the IMF. You have to, you know, debt slavery forcing you to adopt policies that these banks demand, forcing the imposition of carbon markets on various countries. And what's crazy, if it could get any crazier, I didn't really mention some of the other members of this alliance. I mentioned just the leadership, but of course you have the head of Banco Santander, which is like the second biggest or biggest bank in Spain, Bancolombia, the main bank of Colombia, Citibank, Bank of America, HSBC, chair of the investment committee of the David Rockefeller Fund, and chief executive officer of the London Stock Exchange Group. These are bankers here that do not give a flying fuck about the planet. Okay. And to top it all off, we have Larry Fink of BlackRock here on this alliance. Hooray. What did Larry Fink say at COP26 on November 2nd? He said, if we're going to get serious about climate change in the emerging world, we're going to have to really focus on the reimagination of the World Bank and the IMF. He says, quote, they are the senior lender and not enough private capitals coming into the emerging world today because of the risk associated with the political risk. If we are serious about elevating investment capital in the emerging world, I'm urging the owners of these institutions, the equity owners, to focus on how we reimagine these institutions and rethink their charter. They are going to take what is already a weaponized financial institution or institutions and re-weaponize them with this in mind, targeting expressly the emerging world. Specifically, it's probably going to be because of the people on this board, a big focus on Latin America, probably also Africa. which is also coincidentally where they want to have a lot of their fourth industrial revolution workforce be. It's a mess. So China and Russia don't need to go for these guys to do real damage, is I think the point that I wanted to make there. But what's insane is that they've essentially announced that they're going to be re-weaponizing these financial institutions to impose these policies on countries. And obviously, because of what's happened with coronavirus, numerous countries, not that just the U.S., right, have inflation issues coming down the pipe, or that are already showing themselves. And then you have countries perpetually in a tussle, I guess you could say, that never ends with these banks, like Argentina and the IMF, for example. And now they're going to, you know, have a gun to their head to implement all of these policies in a major way. It looks like this is how they're going to start doing it, at least in emerging economies, because they're going to need to be bailed out, right? And, you know, the derivatives bubble that's been inflating ever since 2008, and you know, the crisis then, everything that they've done since, and created this, you know, economy built to fail so that they can implement their new economic system, right? When that collapse happens, they're going to use all of these tools that they're developing at their disposal to try and force this fascism on the world. It's scary stuff, but we need to be talking about this, like, you know, while it's happening, and not wait until we're blindsided with it months down the line. We have to know what they're planning in advance, and they're telling us. I mean, they're being very straightforward about what their plans are.
Yeah, and this takes me back to one of the books that really woke me up to this entire scam. Back in 2007, I was going on vacation. My friend gave me the book by John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I read that book and it changed my life. He outlined the scam of the IMF and the World Bank and how they would approach countries like Ecuador. And they would say, you've got this great topography here. You've got this perfect setup for a hydroelectric power plant. We build this dam. It'll take, you know, this much money, but don't worry, we've got the loan set up for you through the IMF and World Bank. It'll generate all this electricity. It'll generate all this revenue. Yeah, we'll put a couple $1 million in your bank account, you know, president of Ecuador or whatever. We'll make it work. And then they sign on to this deal and the money comes and the hydroelectric power plant gets built, but it doesn't generate the revenue that they said it was going to generate because it was never meant to. It was always a trap, and they fall behind on their payments. And then, like any good loan shark, the IMF and World Bank and John Perkins, who worked for a company called Main, which is like the equivalent of Halliburton, a multinational engineering firm, he would say, you know, listen, you owe my guys a lot of money, and they want to get paid, but maybe we can work something out, right? Maybe you can vote our way in a UN resolution, or you can you know, you privatize your lumber industry and let my buddies buy it, or some deal that this country doesn't want. They now have no choice because they've borrowed money from the wrong people, fallen into debt, and now it's come due. And when Larry Fink or any of these, or Larry Summers or whoever is talking about getting the IMF and World Bank involved in having a more prominent role in the South American continent and Africa, I just keep seeing that Admiral Akbar meme, like, it's a trap, you know, I just like, guys, it's a trap. Don't do it. Don't fall into this, because when Perkins was writing about it, it was UN resolutions and US military bases that you had to build. This time around, it will be imposing COVID-like restrictions. It will be allowing these social credit systems to be implemented. It will be about these carbon tracking systems. All of this stuff will be brought in as a result of, definitely if they fall behind on their payments, but probably even conditional just in getting the money in the first place at this point, especially if it's a country that's experiencing massive hyperinflation. And my guess would be that before they target a particular country to approach them about, you know, signing on to this deal, they'll manipulate the country's currency for a couple months or maybe even a couple years in advance to get them all softened up and ready to accept some sort of quote bailout from the IMF and World Bank, which will be coming with most definitely very large strings attached to it. And so they'll find a way to get these countries to participate, because this is a strategy that the IMF and World Bank have been using for a very long time. It works extremely well. And if I know it's happening and I'm just some dummy that writes books and does podcasts, I got to believe that the heads of these African nations and these South American nations know about this as well. But maybe it's just a matter of greed. Maybe it's an offshore bank account in the Cayman Islands that's got, $75 million in it with your, and here's the number to it. If you play ball with this, I mean, stranger things have happened. We heard about the president of Belarus saying that the IMF and World Bank offered him $940 million to shut his country down and impose mask restrictions and lockdowns. It's like, well, I wasn't surprised to hear that. I'm sure you weren't surprised to hear that, but I think a lot of people out there might have been if they even heard it in the first place. So the banking establishment, the banking component of this whole thing, though on the surface may appear to most people as really boring, is going to become the most dangerous aspect of all of this, because these bankers, like you said, they don't need Russia and China to get in there and do a bunch of damage. They've done plenty of damage on their own. And if as long as they've got the backing of these world supranational institutions like the IMF and World Bank, they've got all the money in the world on their side.
Yeah, one thing well, they don't just have money. They also have lots of years of pre-planning for this. And some of what, we've already touched on today, like how very likely the spiking food prices, a hunger crisis, supply chain issues, will be used to sort of impose this on the people. All of this that we are currently living in, the script we appear to be on, has its own event 201, like COVID did. And of course, there's other things that preceded COVID as well that were eerily similar the year before, like the Crimson Contagion simulation of the US government about a coronavirus pandemic coming out of China and spreading through the air and an air travel from the guy who Dark Winter is named for, essentially, from
Right.
2001. You know, all of these weird coincidences. Well, we have another weird coincidence here in terms of simulations. And this took place in 2015. It was called the Food Chain Reaction Game, brought to you by the Center for American Progress, one of the foremost Washington think tanks that, very much at the center of the Clinton power nexus. I guess you could say, John Podesta and Neera Tanden, those people run that institution, along with the World Wildlife Fund, which, if you think the World Wildlife Fund is just the cute little panda and they love the planet, please go look at like their board of directors and business partners, their alliances with groups like the World Economic Forum and their partnership with the very groups developing the protocols to financialize nature. You will see that the World Wildlife Fund is definitely something very different. And they partnered, those two groups partnered with Cargill and
Well,
Mars Inc. Like,
candy
which
bars.
makes like junk food, right? Cargill being one of the biggest and most predatory companies in big agriculture around, basically. These guys all teamed up for something called the Food Chain Reaction Simulation. And it's definitely worth people's attention because of what came out of here, because it was talking about climate, hunger, civil unrest, spiking food prices, are all essentially used during this exercise, which took place in 2015, but was gaming out the decade 2020 to 2030. It concludes with the US, the EU, India, and China coming together to institute a global carbon tax and cap carbon emissions in 2030. And then the Cargill guy that attended, then their corporate vice president, he went on to say, "We've learned that a carbon tax is a possibility in the years ahead. But before we can consider moving ahead with a measure like that, we must study it and understand it much better." And so, these guys have been looking at this stuff for a long time. They also talk about a meat tax, and all these different taxes, essentially. You know, this is all about money. I really wish people would understand the common denominator here with all of these different exercises has very little to do with like actual sustainability and environmentalism, and is all about money and money flows and where that goes and who controls the money and who, you know, is making the money. And it all boils down to finance to a significant degree. And that's why you see so many of these bankers involved in setting these policies and stuff. Because, you know,
you had me at John Podesta. You know what I mean? When John Podesta shows up at this at events like this, and I watched part of his speech, it was difficult to get through. That's an automatic disqualification. I mean, I think people should understand that when we see these simulations, these events, these role playing exercises, that when they get together, this is not, and John Podesta is running it or is involved in any way, that should just be a screaming red flag that says these people aren't trying to figure out how to you deal with a crisis that comes their way. They're trying to figure out how to make a crisis come their way. The reason why they're studying this is they're trying to figure out how to gamify it, how to rig it. We're studying the idea of a carbon tax may happen in the future. We need to study it a little more. That means we need to figure out how to rig it a little bit more. And that, of course, is exactly what you would do with marketplaces like this when you let the banks get involved. Now, the banks have all been found guilty of rigging the current marketplaces, LIBOR, Forex, COMEX. Yeah. They've all been found guilty in courts of law for rigging this. The same banks that will be in charge of these carbon markets. So, you know, excuse me if I have questions about maybe the legitimacy of the Adam Smith invisible hand of marketplace. I mean, these are the guys that give you the invisible middle finger. I mean, this is what they do. They rig marketplaces. So now they've got a brand new casino game, carbon offset credits and whatever and the like, to go along with the tagging of nature that they definitely tend to sell. And if you thought mortgage-backed securities were bad, you know, wait till you see what these maniacs dream up with forest-backed securities or something like that. Oh, we've had a forest fire. Your investment went to zero. You're like, what? You know, I mean, I can just see the scams on top of scams that these guys are going to come up with, all under the guise of saving the planet. And the arrogance, ego, narcissism, mental illness that's all wrapped up in this plan to become the saviors of the planet while absolutely destroying it in the process is just a masterclass in psychopathy. It is so fascinating to watch these people work. Dangerous, obvious, crazy lunatics that should all be institutionalized immediately, of course, but fascinating to watch them, to watch the sort of arrogance of Prince Charles getting up in front of a microphone and telling everybody how he's going to fix humanity is just preposterous and laughable and scary all at the same time. And so it's really an interesting time to be watching this stuff. And I think that one of the things that you've been really great at doing is you've been great at making this what's technical and difficult to understand. You're able to explain it in a way that makes it easy for everybody to kind of understand parts of it. And they can, oh, okay, I get this now. It's kind of like this, or it's kind of like that. Yeah, I get this. And it's tempting to be dismissive of this and think, well, it's going to happen in a couple of years. I got bigger things to worry about now. But that is kind of the way that we got ourselves in this situation, is that we've sort of outsourced this care to other people. Well, I'll let Whitney Webb care about this. I got other things to do. I'll let her write about this. Well, really, we all need to be paying attention to this.
Thank you.
Even if you're not a writer, you know, yeah, even if you're just like somebody that's a casual consumer of this sort of information in the form of podcasts and things like that. Like now, sorry to to inform you, but you now have a role in this as well. Like, it's kind of your duty and obligation to get to understand some of these components of it, because it's going to affect all of us. And the more education and understanding we have of it early, the better chance we have of opposing it in a real way. Because if there's one thing that we've learned, is that these people will steamroll you. If you don't get together in a coordinated way and try and stop them, they're not going to stop themselves. And the plan that they have for humanity is very dystopian and dark. And it's certainly not the type of world that we want to live in.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that people need to keep in mind, too, is that, like, these billionaires and bankers are responsible for creating the current actual crises that exist. And we're just allowing them
it was a bat. It was a bat in a wet market that got loose. That's what it's just bad luck. We just get bad luck.
Know.
If only Andrew Cuomo was there to save us from this bad luck that we have. It's a litmus test too. You know,
I wonder
what he'll do with
his Emmy now.
I think they're trying to take it back from him, because, you know, the Emmys have standards, right? As their virtue signaling all over the place. I mean, give me a break.
That's funny. Oh man,
it's an upside down world that we're living in, but it's a fascinating time to be observing it.
Very, very true. So one thing I do want to point out before we wrap up, also, is what I've mentioned a couple times about them, using a hunger crisis to essentially, drive through a lot of these agendas and stuff. One of the other things that's come out this week at COP26 is a big commitment from Bill Gates to do climate-related funding of new agricultural research, putting a bunch of money into a particular group that is called, I'm not sure exactly what it stands for, but their acronym is CGIAR. And he basically, Bill Gates has been going around making deals with Boris Johnson of the UK, making deals most recently with Naftali Bennett, Prime Minister of Israel. Before that, it was the head of the EU. Basically, going around making public-private partnerships with all of these individuals, I guess you could say. So he's done a couple things. One of the things he's done is the one I mentioned about a climate smart agricultural research, the CGIAR group. But let's keep in mind, what did Bill Gates do before COVID? What was his big evangelist stance? The Green Revolution. Remember that, Charlie?
Yeah.
And how it was all about GMO seeds for India and bringing, it was going to increase yields and make things so much better in places like India and the global south, and how instead we have a huge spike in Indian farmer suicides. They're trapped in debt slavery.
Yeah.
Their yields aren't any better. This is the guy that we're trusting with agriculture. Now we're trusting him with agriculture again, since the whole COVID thing, he was so great at that, right? But this particular group he's funding has the multilateral development banks, talked about earlier, all on board. Governments of pretty much the whole world are there. But in addition to them, you have Syngenta, Kellogg, the Ford Foundation, of course, the Gates Foundation, and the OPEC Fund for International Development. So, you know, that'll have a lot to do with petrochemicals and not exactly climate smart agricultural research.
And I'd also like to remind the humanity that Bill Gates financed the Svalbard Seed Vault in Norway with his partners, the Rockefeller Foundation, Syngenta. And that is a seed vault that is located in the Arctic Circle, about 1,100 kilometers south of the North Pole, built up 400 feet up a cliff, and 300 feet inside that mountain is where all of the actual real seeds have been stored, you know, far away from the commoners so that we can never get to them. But they've taken the step of preserving actual real seeds, natural seeds, millions and millions and millions of them in this large seed vault, and hidden them away from us while simultaneously financing genetically modified seeds, unleashing that onto the world while also buying up all of the farm, as much of the farmland as he can get his hands on. Listen, Bill Gates is a dangerous, dangerous individual. And I know it's been sort of like popular over the last year to kind of bash on Bill Gates or goof on him and everything, but you know, he wears the sweaters and he's kind of dorky and all that stuff. But let's make no mistake about it. Bill Gates is a dangerous individual. He has very big plans for humanity. And it does involve you guys all coming along for the ride and hanging out, you know, with him in cookouts in the summer in Washington. It's not happening.
Yeah, he only grills out with Warren Buffett, his best friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And they also finance the plant-based foods, which are loaded with, you know, like a Impossible Whopper has like 14 million times more phytoestrogen in it than a traditional Whopper and only has 5% fewer calories. So it's not health food. It's some other sort of experiment that Bill Gates is running on us as well. So it's very important for us to keep an eye on our food supply. It's not a stretch to extrapolate out that these people that have shown you such, you know, utter contempt for humanity, that they would at some point try to control the food supply. Of course they would. This is a logical progression in their psychopathy. So they're going to try and take those steps. So it's imperative on us to pay attention to when these guys that you know are bad guys come out of the blue and start talking about saving humanity. Like at COP26, you have John Kerry coming out in skull and bones, John Kerry, mind you, coming out and saying that the U.S. He pledged that the U.S. would have achieved sustainable management of its oceans by 2025. Now, John Kerry is also a very dangerous human being, but he wants to save the oceans. Can you think of anybody else,
Maxwell, Charlie?
Anybody else that wants to save the oceans? I don't know, like Glenn Maxwell. I mean, there's a thing that happens. These guys that are really bad try to do the thing that the Rockefellers did when they were taking bad press. Start the Rockefeller Foundation. Start a cover story. Say, oh, you're going to be doing charity work. Oh, you're trafficking children? Say you want to save the, I don't know, what do you like? Say you want to save the oceans. Okay, fine. I'm going to save the oceans. So you start Terra Mar and you do this whole thing to save the oceans. It's a cover story. And when guys like John Kerry talk about saving the oceans, really what you should just hear is, I want to control the oceans. When Bill Gates says, I want to save the food supply, he wants to control the food supply. These people don't get involved. These are not altruistic people. John Kerry doesn't give a fuck about you. He wants you dead. If it was up to John Kerry, there'd just be far fewer people on this planet. But that guy's in charge of saving the oceans? Like, it's insane. So where we have to get to is sort of an understanding that the people that are going to be presented to us through the mainstream media, which is obviously controlled, as the liberators, the people that are leading the way in this fight against global warming or this fight against food insecurity or whatever. These leaders are going to be profiting from this. And in fact, if you dig deep enough, you will find that they are the worst people to be leading any of this stuff. So it's kind of imperative. Like, it's funny to joke about this stuff now, but it's not going to be real. It's not going to be funny when John Kerry actually is in charge of the oceans. You know, like right now, he just sounds delusional. But when he's in charge of the oceans, you know, it's going to be bad. They're telling, you know, the good news is that it takes a while for these things to kind of play out, so we can examine them now and see them coming, but we have to do something about it or else it's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, what you have with Gates, right? His past evangelism with big agriculture was Monsanto's business model, basically, mm-hmm. right? So right. What do you think his business model is going to be this time with his philanthropic endeavors with agriculture now based as, being sold as being climate smart, as opposed to previously it was, oh, we're going to reduce world hunger and reduce poverty. The opposite of that happened. But they're going, you know, it's increasingly clear. And as that food chain reaction game, I think that makes it even clearer. There's going to be some sort of hunger crisis. They're already talking about it. Who helped make that hunger crisis possible? Shit like the Green Revolution that Bill Gates promoted. This is a manufactured scam to take control of a major system. And of course, Kissinger, who we mentioned is sort of involved in some of these forums and entities, you know, you control the food, you control the people. Okay.
Yes.
I have a feeling Bill Gates is aware of that. And that may explain his interest in farmland, because not only can he, you know, control the food supply by having all this farmland stuff, he can implement these quote unquote climate smart green energy solutions in the U.S. domestically on a massive scale. But through natural asset corporations, he can also charge people even more because he owns the farmland. And thus, if he makes natural asset corporations also on top of the farmland he already owns, you know, and he can monetize the new assets, quote unquote, of that farmland, its soil, for example. I mean, the guy can make a ton of money and just be at the very top of the pecking order of, this neo-feudal society they're trying to create. It's totally insane. Meanwhile, people believe it. People believe that he's here to help. Okay. Just give him your brain in a bag, people.
These people don't want to help us. They've been at the forefront of all of the some of the worst atrocities. They use their wealth for all the wrong things. I'm not opposed to people getting wealthy, have a great idea, start a business, do things the right way, get successful. That's all great, but these people that are being forced, that are put in positions to, as an example, who's giving us this new metaverse and new dystopian hellscape of food? None other than Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg. Don't you find it interesting that they both have identical origin stories? They both started a transformational technology company out of their dorm rooms at Harvard as freshmen. Geeky guys with partners, you know, worked on these things, wound up leaving, have questionable financing ties to their projects. Obviously, Facebook has questions about that. Microsoft did as well. And they go on to start these massive corporations that become behemoths. And then they start creating foundations to then shield their wealth. I mean, they've followed a very similar trajectory. So I'm not surprised that they're all sort of working to create this new version of reality. I'm not certain that these guys are authentic in anything. I'm not certain that a guy like Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates hasn't been planted there, or at least had his, you know, their families sort of on board with this whole thing. Because whether it's starting it in a garage in Silicon Valley, like HP or Apple or Google, or all these origin stories there, or you started in a freshman dorm room at Harvard, they just seem like they're recycling old backstories and using them for the new guys. And one of the things I noticed when I saw the I don't know if it was a commercial, it wasn't a commercial, some sort of like feature showing what Meta is for the metaverse, their little promo video. If you watch that thing play out, when there's a little bit of graphic design that happens in the end when the logo kind of swirls around, and when it swirls around, it swirls around temporarily into a rainbow of colors, which is the exact same logo that all the World Economic Forum people are wearing. So it kind of gives you, if you're watching, it kind of gives you a little nod. You're like, oh, I see that.
Isn't that the Sustainable Development Goal symbol too, though? The like
that's
circle.
It, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's the one. Yeah. The Sustainable Development Circle thing. So it's like, it's sort of a nod, like we're on this team. It's like, okay, well, I know what that team is. That's not the team I want to be on.
Yeah, so. Well, talking about these backstories, right? I mean, I've talked about the origins of Facebook and, I mean, how it was basically set up to Peter Thiel's involvement while he was trying to revive all of these DARPA programs that got shut down by Congress in like 2003, 2004. He turned total information awareness into Palantir, and then he went and became the biggest investor in Facebook and made it an analog of DARPA's LifeLog program that was out of that same office at DARPA. And if you look at, you know, pretty much all these Silicon Valley companies, their backstory is college dropouts in their garage. They were tinkering around and look what they made. And I mean, if you look at all of these guys, it's pretty clear the national security ties were there either from the very beginning or followed not long after these companies got set up, right? Yeah. And, you know, that's true for Bill Gates, that we know at least by 1995, he was making a bunch of shady deals with the Maxwell family, involved with Jeffrey Epstein back that early, potentially earlier, right? Or Google being involved with getting, you know, a CIA involvement from the very beginning, MQTEL funding, all of that stuff. It's pretty clear that these guys were allowed to develop the monopolies they have for a particular reason. And they're not really the private companies you think they are. They're really more of this private public model, because at least today, even if it wasn't evident in the beginning, most of them, if not all of them, are essentially government contractors or have some sort of obvious documented partnership with intelligence agencies for data collection and things like that. So,
yeah,
you know, the backstory is absurd. And, you know, this is the metaverse is really a lot of that infrastructure has been developed by DARPA and the military. And you see the military and big tech coming together on things like the National Security Commission on artificial intelligence to really, like, essentially shape this whole market area within the U.S., which includes the metaverse, together. You know, it's important to point that stuff out. This wasn't just like Zuckerberg's idea, and his sales pitch is clownish. We can be closer together all the time. We can develop new things with great joy. And his whole, I mean, Zuckerberg doesn't believe that shit, and he's not going to live in the metaverse either. Like, you watch his sales pitch too, and he's like, look, you can make your home space, your fake home in the metaverse that isn't real, look like you have a view of the most beautiful place in the world, and he makes it like a view of a beach. That dude owns like a whole island in Hawaii. He's kicking indigenous Hawaiians out of it. He doesn't need the metaverse to have that view. He just fucking takes it from people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So oh, it's like, you just know
there's going to be, peon. There's going to be COVID in the metaverse, right? Like, everyone's going to have to get vaccinated in the metaverse. You're going to be like, this sucks. Oh, man. I came here thinking I was going to get away from this, and I caught metaverse AIDS or something. You know, they'll do some, you know, I mean, these guys are such maniacs. They'll be out there creating all of the worst components of society inside this metaverse so that it will, you know, remind you of home.
Remind you of home. It'll be like the only way. They'll be like, you want to feel like you're in the forest or with grass under your feet. Only way to do it is the metaverse, because you've you've existed too much and gone beyond the limits of carbon and whatever else that we have prescribed. So the only way you can experience any of that is to do it virtually. It's insane. Yeah. This is a crazy world we are making for ourselves. Well, I know, Charlie, that your book touches on a lot of craziness far beyond what we've talked about today, essentially covering the world of cultural double standards. Is there anything from there that you'd like to touch on before we wrap up for today?
Well, it's funny that I start the book talking about some of the hypocritical components of society, and I mention private jets with Al Gore and John Travolta and Leonardo DiCaprio and all the Davos crowd. So it's kind of appropriate that we start by talking about all of the inbound jets to discuss climate, you know, and Leonardo DiCaprio flying off to Europe to accept his Sustainable Development Achievement Award, and then making a detour after that trip and heading down to the south of France to go party for a week on a yacht, the fifth largest yacht in the world, that carbon footprint is as big as most, as some small cities. And so when you see stuff like this, it's just like it's funny when Leonardo DiCaprio does it, or John Travolta, who's got a bunch of airplanes and is talking about climate change and things like that. So it's sort of like, ha ha, funny and ironic, and look at these dummies. But it takes a more serious turn when you start to get into some of the other hypocritical components of this, about Saul Alinsky's plans, where you talk about how these people are using the woke mob as a force for, you know, to culturally subvert the current society. So what I wanted to do in the book was show people where this hypocrisy is pooling, mostly in the media, the corporate media, obviously the government, the COVID cult, the woke mob, all these people, the, you know, the religious organizations, and then show as many examples of it and footnote this insanity as best I can, because, you know, I had to put 480 footnotes in there, because when you're talking about some of this, some of these things that sound too nuts to be real, you kind of have to show your work, or else people would just assume you're being silly, or yeah, you're being, you know, you're just being over the top with it. And it's like, no, I couldn't be this funny if I tried. I couldn't do things like criminalize the collection of rainwater in Oregon and make it a crime to collect that on your property. I mean, I couldn't ever come up with you know, the sorts of things that they're doing. I'm not that funny, but I can certainly document it and define it and show. So I put the cover of the book has Uncle Sam, that Uncle Sam character, in a straight jacket, in an insane asylum in a padded room. And I think that I feel like if people take a look at that book cover, they'll say, oh, I get it. I know what you're talking about. We've all gone insane here. Yes, it's true. We have all gone insane. But there's some funny parts throughout it, of course. I do a nice little, I have some fun with the guys, you know, like the televangelist hypocrites, like Joel Osteen and Ted Haggard and Jimmy Swaggart and all those guys that, you know, I talk about the religion of the state, statism, and those sorts of hypocritical beliefs that people have, that the state is going to come and save them and things like that. And I also, of course, get into the never ending like fear porn that we get from the mainstream media with Y2K and anthrax and West Nile virus and weapons of mass destruction and SARS, and just a long list of every single year there's a new catastrophe that's going to kill all of us. And so I put a lot of charts in there and had a good time with it. So I think people will be, I think the humorous parts will keep them laughing, keep them in there, sticking with it. I think the footnotes will give them a place to go to sort of see that I'm not just making up this, this insanity. It's actually real and it's documented and it's actually happening. And I think that it's a nice way for people to get a good, like if you like The Daily Show when Jon Stewart was doing it, and you like to laugh at a good ridiculous story, but still understand the story that Jon Stewart was talking about, I feel like this book could do is kind of in that same vein. It's funny, but I also recognize that we are laughing at some things that are very serious. And so I try to find that balance. So if people are interested, they can find it on Amazon, in digital format as a Kindle and also as a paperback. Hypocrisy. It's like the word hypocrisy, but I switched out the two of the letters at the end. So it says Hypocrazy, Surviving in a World of Cultural Double Standards. I think a lot of people are going to relate to the book. It came out a couple of weeks ago. It's been doing very well. So people can find that there, or they can connect with me at my website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, where they can find out about my podcast, Macroaggressions, my group podcast, The Union of the Unwanted, that we do twice a month. It's been a whole lot of fun, and everything else that I'm up to is there.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thanks so much, Charlie, for coming back on for the third time. Really appreciated having you and your insights and also your humor present to talk about these increasingly dark themes. But I mean, sometimes really you do have to laugh at these people because they're so insane and hypocritical. And it's just, I mean, it's clown world, you know, it's dark and it's crazy, but man, it really is clown world. And sometimes we just have to laugh at these people who think they're our overlords. I think in a way it helps. And for those not familiar with Charlie's work, well, you may have sort of gotten an introduction to this in this and previous podcasts here, but he's incredible at weaving together insights into these issues with humor. So if that is up your street, be sure to check out his stuff.